So thank you for the introduction, and I wanted to just basically tell you how we're going to do this conversation, which we're keeping a bit informal as well. So we want to have some time for questions and answers as well. I actually will step back a little bit and kind of do some sort of moderation, perhaps taking the questions from the audience and passing on the metaphorical microphone as we go along. Sam is going to start talking a little bit about the project that Men was mentioning on the Surrealist Group of Artists in Egypt. It started at Centre Pompidou and then is on a tour in Europe. It's currently in Stockholm at the Moderna Museum. And then afterwards, Sylvia is going to pick up on that and chronologically going perhaps a bit after that time period. You know, our exhibition really looks at the time until 48 and a little bit the years after. And Sylvia is going to pick up from that and talking a bit about modernism in Egypt, but also spreading it out a little bit into the region. So I will stop here and give the stage to Sam.
Thank you so much, and it's a pleasure being back at the Mosaic Rooms. Thank you for having us again. Just to clarify, we did not curate the exhibition between 1938 and 1948. We're not that old, okay? No, we're very happy to be here, and there's a lot of material to cover, there's a lot to talk about, so we're trying to be as informal, as informative as well, and leave the discussion to unroll and unfold as it will. So how do we actually tell the story of Ahli Bihti? Who were Ahli Bihti? And the reason why we're talking about this also is because it will give you a different context to the story of Hamid Abdallah. We're not going to be talking about the exhibition upstairs, but the more we kind of unpack some of these different groups, these different movements, we will get perhaps, hopefully, a better understanding of the context from which Abdallah comes and what he was responding to. So Ahli Bihti were a group of artists that really came together just before the beginning of the Second World War. And some of the points that, we would like to focus on, I just will give you a brief, outline, and it's going to be very, very concise when I talk about it. Basically, we'd like to look a little bit at the forming factors and the key players that led to the formation of the group and who contributed to what the group stood for, what they did. Then we're going to try and talk a little bit about why surrealism. They were a surrealist group, working in Cairo in the 30s and the 40s. So what was the interest in surrealism? Where was the interest in surrealism coming from? And how did they use it as a means of creating a certain rupture or revolution? We're also going to talk about their contribution to surrealism. So, many people might think that they were looking at surrealism elsewhere and trying to bring some of what was happening in Paris or in London or in the so-called center to the so-called periphery. But we're going to propose a different way of looking at the group by highlighting their contributions to the movement. And then, ultimately, since the title of today's talk is Relocating Modernism, we would like to propose maybe a different way of looking at modernism, a different way of studying or kind of trying to understand some of these different manifestations of modernity, modernism in different parts of the world through what we're referring to as transmodernism. Instead of talking about Orientalism a la Sa'id, instead of talking about post-colonial discourse, maybe there's a new way of looking at these things, and this is what we're referring to as transmodernism. So, who were the Art and Liberty group? They were a group of young, mostly young men and women, Egyptian and non-Egyptian, political activists, writers, and definitely visual artists who came together upon the eve of the Second World War and published a manifesto, Long Live Degenerate Art, taking a stand with against fascism, against the Nazis and the oppression of artists in Europe, but also trying to make a stand against the local status quo when it comes to how certain kind of institutions were having a very strong hegemony over the art scene in Cairo, whether it's conservatism, bourgeois aesthetics, and a certain propaganda or a certain nationalism that was seeping into different art institutions at the time. And this was happening at the beginning, right before the the Second World War. And the pamphlet from one of their exhibitions at the beginning of the war is very interesting, which starts with the words, "In this hour, when the entire world cares for nothing but the sound of cannons, we have found it our duty to provide a certain artistic current with the opportunity to express its freedom and its vitality. So it's very important to understand that, you know, the Second World War was a very, very important backdrop to the concerns, the questions, the raison d'être, in a way, of that group. They were really, really implicated in thinking about the political aspects of what was going on. And, you know, some of you might not realize the extent to which Cairo and Egypt experienced the war. One of the main battles that shifted the course of the war took place on the Egyptian-Libyan border in Alamein in 1943. And given the fact that Egypt was a form of veiled protectorate under British colonial rule, by de facto, it was obliged to place all its natural resources under, you know, the British Empire if England were to ever go to war, which it did. So basically, the soldiers were coming in, 200,000 soldiers, the 8th Army, as it was referred to, was based in Egypt, 140,000 soldiers just outside of Cairo. So you can imagine the impact that this had on the group, both in terms of their literature and in terms of their art. Here we see examples from the display of this section at the Centre Pompidou. So you can see they were talking about fascism, criticizing it, of course. They were creating these caricatures, making fun of Hitler and Mussolini. But then they were creating unbelievably powerful imagery that was borrowing from the surrealist aesthetic. This is very much in the vein of maybe Hieronymus Bosch or some of the deformed figures that you see in other surrealist works that you might be more familiar with. And this is a work by Samir Rafa from 1945, which he started in 1943 at the age of 17, commenting on the bombing of Alexandria. So the war is a very, very important aspect to keep in mind. And of course, Maillot de Saint-Cruel, 1937, the anxiety preceding the war. Laurent Marcel Salinas, again, 1944, the deformation of the body, the mutilation of the corpses that sometimes were being seen in images in the press or, you know, listening to about all these battles that were going on. Another thing that the war kind of led to was the influx of refugee artists and writers and activists who became ultimately group members. And I can, you know, list a few. For instance, Lawrence Darrell, the very important British author, was in Cairo during the Second World War. Nathan Lovett Turner, who was married to the director of the British Council in Latvia, and then they came to Egypt, and he became the director of the British Council there. But she was a brilliant artist. Robert Medley, who was a surrealist artist, who had taught some of the younger artists who had studied in England before the war, and then moved to war as a soldier and became part of the group. Angelo Deris, an Italian anti-fascist who was an art teacher at the Lycée de Duquev. Eric Donemes, a Hungarian artist who was living in Beirut, who then moved to Cairo. So there's a lot of examples. Etienne Svet, the Hungarian Jewish photographer, who also came to Cairo seeking refuge and worked as a photographer and was a member of the group. So this kind of internationalism was one of the maybe collateral benefits of the war, that all these people were coming to Cairo. And this is exactly one of the things that the group kind of preached, especially with the publication of the manifesto in 1938, that we invite artists to come and work freely in Cairo. All the refugees, come to Cairo, you can express yourselves, you don't have to worry about the oppression that you might be experiencing in Europe by the Nazis and the fascists, which is ironic given the politics of today and how, you know, the course of history changes. So, you know, this is just to give you an example of how we displayed the manifesto in one or two of the venues where the exhibition has been. And their complete stand against, you know, the oppression of artists and their championing of what was referred to as entartete kunst or degenerate art. And this is, again, one of the installations from the Kunstsammlung in Düsseldorf of the war section and this kind of stand against fascism, which in a certain way was also expressing itself locally. There were a lot of political parties in Egypt that were modeling their youth groups after the Camici Neri, for instance, in Italy, the youth groups of the Nazi parties. So there were a lot of demonstrations happening on the streets, and this kind of relegation of art or the avant-garde, in particular surrealism, to a form of moral decay was sometimes seeping into the writings that were coming up in reviews in Cairo. So, you know, one of the reviews of one of the Art et Liberté exhibitions speaks very, very openly against what they were doing. Surrealism presents a danger to our ever-growing civilization. It's truly, you know, we should fight it because it's heading straight into the slime of moral decay. So you can imagine that this kind of fear of fascism was something that was also kind of happening or growing locally. So the manifesto, the raison d'etre of the group was as much globally concerned, yet locally informed, and trying to take a stand, you know, against both kind of axes, outside and inside. So in a sense, just to talk very quickly about some of the main group members: Rosh Hanane, Kamel Telmisani, Anwar Kamel, Fuad Kamel, Ramses Younan. Rosh Hanane was an integral part of the group because he had studied in the Sorbonne. He had lived as a teenager in Madrid, in Italy. He was half Italian. His mother was Egyptian-Italian, half Egyptian. And he was really kind of the promoter of what the group was doing internationally. He was a poet, and he would communicate with a lot of surrealist figures everywhere in the world, and they would communicate with the group through him. So for instance, this is one way in which we try to show the centrality of the Cairo group in the exhibition display. And you see that the Cairo, as far as the international surrealist movement was concerned, was not a marginal group. It was actually a central part of the discourse that was happening at the time. So, for instance, Bruxelles, 1946, a letter from Magritte to Henri Liberté, to Georges Hanane, in which he's presenting a new draft of a new manifesto of surrealism, saying to Georges Hanane to pass it on to the group, to review it, and maybe be one of the signatories of the different internationalist groups that were rethinking the meaning and definition and application of surrealism at the time. So Henri Liberté looked at the draft of the manifesto, and then Georges Hanane writes to Magritte and says, "We are not convinced by the intellectual premise of this new manifesto, and we'd rather stick for the time being with the, you know, established convention of what surrealism has been, you know, so far." So they were really engaged in a conversation, sometimes agreeing, sometimes disagreeing. And this was not something that was only happening in Egypt. It was happening actually in a lot of places. You know, you have to think Japan was experiencing a renovated kind of expression of surrealism, where surrealism began with an exhibition in 1936. The same was happening in Mexico with an international exhibition in 1940. The same was happening in Martinique with Césaire and a lot of intellectuals and artists who were also trying to find a new application of surrealism, a younger generation after the original or initial kind of generation of the Breton Circle in Paris. Maillot was an important protagonist. He had studied in France in the 20s. He comes back to Egypt in the 30s, and he creates some of the most stunning works when he was actually living there, illustrating some of the books of some of the fellow group members like Les Pieds en l'air of Jabez. Great painting, Coup de Bâton, Blows of Sticks, commenting on police brutality against activists and maybe writers who were distributing pamphlets like the Manifesto of Henri Liberté. Louis Miller is another example of one of the important kind of instigators of surrealism in Egypt. She was married to Aziz Alwi Bey, an Egyptian businessman, living in Cairo from 1934 until 1939. And in 1936, she was in Europe. She meets British surrealist Roland Penrose, who falls in love with her. They start an affair. He starts coming to see her in Cairo. Her husband was pretty aware of the whole matter and asked them to only meet in the house outside the city. So he was quite enlightened in that way. I don't know. But what's really exciting is the fact that she was creating some of her most surrealist, you know, striking surrealist photography at the time. But she was also introducing the group and opening her house for surrealist seances. London, for instance, the London Bulletin, the British surrealist publication, publishes the Manifesto of Henri Liberté in April 1939, only a few months after it was published in Cairo. They also publish other works by other surrealist writers from Cairo, and it's very, very interesting to see these connections. Here you see, for instance, a postcard from Penrose to Miller telling her that he's meeting Man Ray and Hanane in Paris. So the idea of them being part of the circle and part of this conversation is very, very interesting. And then last but not least, Amy Nimmer is a very, very important also figure in the history of surrealism in Egypt. She had studied in France, she had studied at the Slade, but then she had a studio in France at the Rue de la Tombe Isoire, which is known as Villa Soga, the area. And that's where Henry Miller, Anaïs Nin, Dali, Mayo had their studios, their apartments, and there was a revisionist approach to surrealism coming there. In 1936, Henry Miller publishes an open letter to the surrealists everywhere, in which he accuses them of becoming a movement, while they were always pretending to be the advocates of revolution. And he starts talking about anarchism as the only way forward, you know. And a lot of the group members in Cairo were actually totally anarchists. So some of them were Trotskyites, some of them started more in, like, more orthodox communism, but eventually a lot of them became, you know, total anarchists. And so this is the Rue de la Tombe Isoire, and this is some of the work that Amy was creating when she was there. So why surrealism? And I realize, you know, we don't have so much time, and I'm just going to flick through the slides. This gives you an example of what was happening in Cairo at the time when Aghli Bekhti came around. There was this kind of conservative bourgeoisie aesthetic promoted by the École de Beaux-Arts of Cairo, which was founded in 1908, and by a société called the Société des Amis de l'Art, which was very, very close to the, you know, to the state, kind of promoting a sense of nationalism, neo-Faronism, work that was really about constructing an image of a modern nation. And if you go to the British Museum at the moment, there's a beautiful project on display, you know, Becoming Modern, that shows this conflation of ancient Egypt with modernity at the time. So they were really conservative, you know, advocating romanticism, symbolism, naturalism. And there's all these young artists who were not interested. They were really standing against everything that this society and this kind of older generation represented. And this is how we try to show this confrontation in the exhibition. So they adopted surrealism because they felt the language of surrealism was the antithesis of everything that the art styles that this kind of more conservative faction of the art society in Egypt represented. So by deforming the human body, Ramses Younan, Asufas Dissab, Mayou, Hassan Al-Tilmisani, you know, Maher Raif, all these works, you know, are completely going against the beauty, the championing of heroism, the sublime, and showing really the misery of people by breaking the human body and mutilating it. They're showing the suffering, they're showing the fact that poverty is not something beautiful and heroic. So they want to show all these things through imagery that creates a certain, you know, guttural response. Of course, they also wanted to comment on a very specific World War II specific condition, which was actually the fact that due to the influx of soldiers, due to the Second World War, there was a huge proliferation in prostitution. So in a way, they looked at women and felt that they were being sites for men to wage their own wars. And they wanted to show the deformation of the female figure as a means of protesting against the abuse of women. Because of prostitution and because of poverty. They were extremely feminist in a way. They were talking about the right of women to vote. There were a lot of women artists were part of the group, not as muses a la Breton style, but as equal partners who were actually contributing intellectually through literature, through writing. You know, Marie Cavadia, Amy Nimmer, to give an example, Inge Iflaton as painters, but also as sometimes as patrons who were opening their houses and inviting these artists to come and work and meet each other. So these are all examples of some of these works that try to show the suffering of women. Inge Iflaton showing women as anthropomorphic trees, and Kamel Tilmisani showing a theme of an animal trying to come out from the body of the woman to devour the lovers who are using her body, based on a poem by Georges Hanin called St. Louis Blues, in which he talks about La Femme de la Ville, which is a metaphor for the prostitute. So, you know, this was happening, as I said, at a time when surrealism was undergoing a large kind of reconfiguration in different parts of the world, as I said, in Mexico, in the Martinique. And I'm going to finish here, actually, with this slide, and then we can talk later about transmodernism in the conversation. I don't want to take too much time. Basically, One of the most important contributions of Atelier Berthet to Surrealism lies in their new definition of Surrealism that they coined in 1939. That year, Ramses Younan, one of the main artists in the group, publishes a book called Ghayat al-Rassam al-Asri, The Purpose of the Contemporary Artist or Painter, in which he talks about Surrealism, and he describes it as a movement that is faltering in its steps, that doesn't know where it needs to go. And he actually mentions or describes two kinds of Surrealism. He talks about the Surrealism of Dali, of Magritte, that is too premeditated and too preconceived. When you create a pipe and you write ceci n'est pas un pipe, that's not at all the work of the subconscious anymore. When you create a horse with a melting clock, that's not something spontaneous. It's something that has been undergoing a lot of thinking. So they were not interested, Atelier Berthet, in that form of Surrealism. On the other hand, he says that there's the Surrealism of automatic drawing and writing, which is all about the subconscious and the artist going into themselves and unleashing their inner thoughts. And that becomes too self-referential and introverted. The artist loses their ability to connect to their public. So we need a way that kind of fuses the two. And that's where they suggest subjective realism. By subjective, they mean the freedom of the artist to pick any theme, topic, style they want to work with. By realism, trying to pick up on things that the public could identify with from the reality in which they live. So this example is a brilliant example of one work by Younan from 39, in which he uses the goddess Nut, the ancient goddess of the sky, as a broken figure in a surrealist style. And if you're an Egyptian who's aware of their history and their vernacular, you would see that in the painting and you would realize that it's a comment about maybe the situation in Egypt at the time. Roland Penrose did another work when he was in Egypt the same year, and he called it Egypt, and he also depicted Lee Miller as Nut. So you can see how these artists were looking at the same source, but each identifying with it in a different way. Mayo creates the a painting called Loiseau, and he places a pharaonic eye in it. So just a few examples of their main contribution and the fact that they were part of a very important center of discussion, of conversation. They were contributing, they were open to other suggestions, and they were coming back with their own formulations intellectually and visually. They had two publishing houses as well, so they were publishing prolifically. And I'll just finish that in 1945, when the war finished, they published, or the wife of Georges Hénin published, a book called La Vertu de l'Allemagne, The Virtue, or The Virtues of Germany. Now you have to imagine 1945 with the horror of the concentration camps and everything that is coming out from Germany. Nobody was talking about the virtues of Germany. Germany was the biggest evil in the world. And here you have this group of artists who in 1938 were the first to condemn what was happening in Germany by saying, long live entartete Kunst, degenerate art, were the first to say, wait a second, we're not going to go on a crucifying campaign. There's always something good everywhere. And let's look at the art and the literature and the music and that came out from Germany for decades, for centuries. So perhaps between these two parentheses, I will leave you to ponder a little bit what the group was. And sorry if I was too fast, but there's so much to talk about. And I want to...
Yes. I already probably spoke too long. Thank you so much. Maybe just at one point, I think, to the discussion, since the exhibition, or the talk, sorry, today is on relocating modernism. And I think the standpoint when we were conceiving the project as an exhibition falls quite well within this sort of theme. And for us, it was in fact very important not to make any comparisons or hang, surrealist paintings next to Egyptian paintings and make these kind of comparisons and having people then say, oh, maybe that's better or worse, or this is a copy, this is an original. I think it's very important when one attempts these kind of projects is actually to go back to the story of the people and the artists themselves, and really take the time and the effort and the troubles to go to all the original sources, trace all the descendants, and really, really take those years that it takes to actually tell the real story from within their own perspective. And that was really our core objective. We were not interested at all in making a comparison or sort of say this, but just tell the story from the perspective. And I think in doing that, you automatically, as a viewer to the exhibition or when you read the books, you're transported into Cairo, which into Cairo of the 1930s and 1940s, And you really actually discover a completely different perspective simply by doing that, because that was simply the reality of those artists as they were living there. And then, of course, that complicates art history. And I think the key thing that we're advocating for a little bit is not so much to integrate other modernisms into a canon. This is kind of often said, because that sort of implies that the canon itself is correct, first of all, because maybe the canon itself is not really correct. And this notion of integrating carries very often something a bit patronizing, you know. We sort of are the mothership, and then we get the other things sort of to kind of connect to us. And that often actually leads to a very tinted perspective that already comes with a preconceived answer, instead of asking the questions first and then see what does it actually mean for the origin of where you came from, you know. And that's, I think, proper academic perspectives we believe in. We look forward to hearing now from Sylvia to kind of take us a bit more into more present times. So.
Well, probably not too much, but thank you for this introduction. Thank you to the Mosaic Rooms for inviting me to London. I'm very happy to be here to have the opportunity to see this beautiful exhibition. Sam already made the transition a little bit to the two points which I would like to stress here, in order also to put them in relation with the Hamid Abdallah exhibition that you have here. One point, which you already mentioned in some way, is the idea of how to construct, how to build, on which elements to build a modernism. And I will shift a little bit. I will start with Cairo, but then I will shift a little bit more eastwards and go to Iraq, where you have similar kind of reflections about what modernity in an Arab world can be and what many artists would find as being a way of constructing such a modernity. As you said already, there was an academic art which started in the beginning of the 20th century and somewhere in some places even at the end of the 19th century, which established itself in art schools, or at least in exhibitions, and I would say in art lovers' societies. And so this is also, and this is one point. The other point is we shift also to another era. Fascism is not a concern anymore. We are after World War II, and I would say it's the important. It's a time of national liberation in the Arab world, but also all around the world, the time of tiers-mondism, of revolutions, what they called revolutions at that time, and also as we could also go back to a definition that Muhammad Al-Kun gave as for the periodization of history in the Arab world or of history of thought in the Arab world, and I think we can apply it to some degree also to art history, making this distinction between the Nahda period, which is the period that starts in the 19th century, and for him ends in the 1950s, which he calls the period of Thawra, of revolution. Revolution meaning regime changes most of the time, like in Egypt with Nasser and in Iraq and in other places. But all these movements, these political movements, had also an impact on the way artists were thinking about how they should produce art. Even if very often, as Hamid Abdallah, they were or they became opponents to the regimes, which in the beginning they may have backed in some way. And the second point, which I would like to stress also in relation to, for instance, this work here, is something which will develop slowly with many artists and will come up into a more organized trend, let's say, in the 1970s, after the 1970s, and then sometimes even become a kind of easy recipe of making Arab art, which is the reference to, I would say, to the Arabic script. I don't want to name it differently. I would say the Arabic script. I don't want to say the letter. I mean, of course, the movement will be named later on hurufiya, from the Arab word, the Arabic word, huruf, letters. But I think if we look at Hamid Abdallah and at others, we will see it's more complicated. And in any way, it is not calligraphy, but I will come back to this. I mean, it has no relation with Islamic calligraphy, and even if painters like Hamid Abdallah had a training in calligraphy, he is not working like an Islamic calligrapher, and he doesn't make any kind of reference to this kind of work. So, in order to stay, or to start with Egypt, one of the first groups, and which had a reflection on how modernity had or should develop, or what the ways could be to build a kind of modernity, and taking some of the lessons, of course, of Art et Liberté, and some of the artists like Abdelhadi Al-Ghazzar had also exhibited with Art et Liberté in the last exhibitions, yes, because
44,
they were
45.
Yes, because they were younger people. This is also, I mean, there is also a kind of generational change. And what really comes up, and which is important for those artists, is to try to be modern, but also to have this kind of modernity in some way rooted in what they name, maybe not at that time yet, but what they imagine to be some kind of local visual heritage. I don't want to name it tradition because it would be wrong, but I would say a visual heritage. And you have different forms of reference to this visual heritage. You see it here in a later work of Abdelhadi Al-Ghazzar called The Fortune Teller, where you have a very strong reference to what we can call a popular visual culture, to tattoos, to some forms of magics, to just objects used in the more popular areas of Cairo. What is also very important with Ghazzar and with his fellow Nada, which whom I will show afterwards, is also what you had always with Art et Liberté. They were still struggling against some kind of academical bourgeois, let's rather say bourgeois vision of art. And in this bourgeois vision of art, there was also, I mean, since art in a Western modality started in Egypt and in other countries, one of the favorite topics, which was in some way taken up from Orientalism, was the representation of inhabitants of the popular areas of the cities or of the rural areas. And in a quite romanticizing way, you never saw the hardship of these areas. And what Ghazzar, for instance, and Nada, at least in the beginning, do, they represent the hardship of the life of people in popular neighborhood where they were also coming from, so they knew also the context. And it's something I would say, this is also a very good example, if you just turn to the right, probably, which is a painting by Hamid Abdallah, which goes into the same kind of consideration. I mean, referring to some kind of visual heritage in forms, in colors, in attributes, but at the same time also showing that life is not an Orientalist dream with nice women and fellah and so on. A more paradigmatic painting of what this reference to a kind of heritage could be in a larger way. Of course, you still have here, I think this is a pointer, yes, you still have here a reference to, I would say, handicraft. This is a kind of carpet, Bedouin carpet that you have here, out of which this boat, this ship is built. But of course, you have also the reference to pharaonic art, which was already quoted in by Egyptian artists in earlier period. But the idea is that there has to be a reference to what is considered, what is heritage is not really clearly defined, but what is clear, it's everything that was somewhere before colonialism, before the Europeans came. And the interesting thing is that be it in Egypt or in other places, everything pre-Islamic is also integrated into this narration. I think this is also very important. It's also very important in consideration of the term modern or contemporary Islamic art, which is used today. Those artists were not at all referring to Islamic art, so this was not their main consideration. This is also an interesting painting by Ghazzar, which is representing his wife. And why is it interesting? Because it is, he dresses his wife in some kind of invented, I would say, traditional dress, more or less, and he puts her towards a background of, again, this kind of motifs that you would find in tattoos and other visual expressions of the popular neighborhoods. And it's also a way of breaking with what can be a kind of bourgeois tradition of portrait painting. Now, the same kind, so I would say this kind of work, you would find it in several places, in several urban centers, of course, of the Arab world at that time. But I would say the main two centers in the 1950s would be Cairo and Baghdad. Baghdad, which didn't have the same old tradition of, let's say 50 years old tradition of academic painting as Cairo had, they had a few painters who were more amateur painters, and the first Iraqis who went to study art were sent in the 1930s to different cities in Europe, in mostly Rome, Paris, and a little bit London. And the interesting thing about Iraq is that this kind of practice of art is also put into a theoretical work. And the group who is forming it, I mean, there are several groups of artists, but there is one group especially which is interesting because they theorize what they want to practice, and this group is the Baghdad group for modern art. And this group is led by Jawad Selim. Jawad Selim, who was a multilingual intellectual. He was married to an English woman. He had studied in Rome, in Paris, and then in London. And the group published two manifestos, one in 1951 and one in 1955. And the interesting thing about the first manifesto is they proclaim what they want to do. And what they want to do is to have a modern art. This is very important. It's not, I mean, there is no discussion about going back to Islamic art or some kind of older practice of the region. But they say we have to know our local production that we don't know in order to attain a universal value in our art. So the idea is that they would have to go back to what Iraq has produced, and Iraq again considered as a territory from the very ancient times, from the Assyro-Babylonian times, of course not in the kind of Saddam Hussein delirium that you had later, but in an intellectual reflection about this. And also what is very strong, you have the reference, to do the reference also to popular motifs. If you look at his paintings, it also looks, it is built like a carpet, again a Bedouin carpet, of course not the Persian carpet. And what is very important with Jawad Selim is also the motif of the crescent. Again, it's not a symbol of Islamism in that sense, it's just a shape that you have in everyday life and that he uses to build up his paintings. What is also important, the kind of flat colors, but this is anyway a characteristic of modernism. You might see some architectural shapes like here, and maybe, I don't know if we should read these dots like the dots of the Arabic script. Anyway, this is too early, sorry. Two references we would find in the manifesto of the Baghdad group. One is very clearly Picasso. Why Picasso? Because Picasso, as a Spaniard, was able to come back, this is the what you find in the manifesto, to the art of ancient Spain, of his country. So Picasso is a kind of model, not somebody to copy, but somebody to follow in his way of producing art. And the other important figure quoted in the manifesto and which will become a kind of reference in Iraqi art generally is Yahya Al-Wasiti. Al-Wasiti was a miniature painter of the 13th century from the town of Al-Wasit, which is in the center of Iraq, Wasit. And he is known for this maqamat, for his illustration of the maqamat by Al-Hariri. There are several versions of manuscripts. And he is one of the manuscript painters who signed the manuscripts. So what the painters of the Baghdad group are interested in Alwar city is not the style. They don't want to do miniature painting. They are really trained in a kind of Western style painting. They want to stay in it because they want to produce an international art. But, and this is the interesting thing, once Alwar city gives them a kind of legitimation of doing modern art, because it's a way of saying, we have a tradition of painting, but now we are doing it in another way. But Alwar city becomes a kind of spiritual reference for Iraqi art. And he becomes a very important, but not only, I will come back to this. And he becomes a very important reference. And the other reference is Picasso. So you have really Picasso, I mean, if we wanted to schematize a little bit, Picasso is modern, the modern art, Western part, and Alwar city is in some way the heritage. But understood as a kind of spiritual heritage, as a kind of way of saying, yes, we have painting in Iraq and it's something that we have to rebuild. That's also what the manifesto says. We have to rebuild on the ruins of the Mongols who destroyed Baghdad and so on. We have to go back on what we had before. But it's not nostalgic. It really is understood as a way of doing new, but taking the example of what existed before. So, one of the members of the group, and I hope I don't know how long I already spoke.
A few more minutes maybe, and then we can
Okay, then I will be very short, and I will try to speak, because he's a very interesting figure, because I wanted to speak about the reference to the Arabic script. Shakir Hasan al-Said was a member of the Baghdad group of modern art. And at that time, he was doing this kind of painting, or this kind, more or less. But then, so he was trained at the Teachers College in Baghdad, then he went to Paris in the 1950s. And, of course, in Paris, he met a lot of people, and he studied maybe at the Beaux-Arts for some time. But the interesting thing, which might be surprising, is that he discovered, while he was in Paris, Sufism. And Sufism was a kind of new start for him. Not because he became a mystic and just sitting down and meditating. No, this was not. He thought about art. And what he did, and this really changed the way that he produced art and he understood art. And in 1966, he published in the literary supplement of the newspaper Al-Jumhuriya a contemplative manifesto. And what is interesting in this contemplative manifesto, he says the artist has not to be a creator in the modern sense. His art has to be something which takes him into elevation. And he uses the word miraj, which is the word for ascension, for the Prophet's ascension in the Islamic tradition. He says also art has to discover the truth, and it has to show what cannot be seen with the eyes, and he uses all the mystic language. But he doesn't want to make meditation or something, but he's building up a theory of art on Sufi vocabulary. It's very interesting. It's not always easy to understand, but it's very interesting. And so he says art has really to be something else and go beyond this kind of individualist art that comes from the Renaissance tradition. It has to show something else, another reality. This is his point in the Contemplative Manifesto. But I also would like to go back to a conference he made in 1964 at the Modern Art Museum in Baghdad, which is about the specificities of Alwar city's art. I said Alwar city is a very important figure, a very important reference in Iraqi art. And what he says in this conference, which is previous to the Contemplative Manifesto, but I quote it here because I want to say it's not only Sufism that inspires Shakir Hassan, there are other elements. And the important thing for him is that Al-Wasiti for him is not somebody who didn't know how to represent reality in a mimetic way, and that's not why he paints the way he paints, but he says he wants to transpose the world into the bi-dimensional, the three-dimensional world into the bi-dimensional of the painting. So he reinterprets what Islamic art historians at that time were disqualifying as a kind of incapacity of Islamic painters to represent in the tradition in a mimetic way the reality. He makes a force out of it, and he says it's an example. And then all these thinkings goes into what he will express in the manifesto Al-Bu'd Al-Wahid, which is the one dimension, which is the manifesto of the Hurufiyya. Now, the Hurufiyya produced a lot of things which go in a lot of direction, but if you go back to the manifesto by Shakir Hassan al-Said, you will see that it's very strongly influenced by this kind of thinking, which is, of course, not what the artists that adhered to the movement mostly produced. But this is an interesting point, and you will see that his painting also change, and you can really see this intellectual evolution, of course, in his paintings, which go from the Alf Leila Wa Leila, Arabian Nights, to more and more abstract paintings in the later years. Now, the important point, and I will conclude on this so that I'm not speaking too much, so we will leave for the audience a little bit of time. Shakir Hassan al-Said, with other Iraqis and other Arabs and Hamid Abdallah and a lot of people, was in Paris in the 1950s. And Paris in the 1950s is still the place where most artists from the rest of the world would go when they go abroad, even if New York is taking over a little bit as a center of art. But what is interesting is that at the end of the 1940s, abstraction finally is accepted in Paris, and this is becomes manifest through the Salon des Réalités Nouvelles, where abstract artists are exhibited. And the other thing you have in Paris, of course, you have Lettrisme with Isidore Isou, who wants to make a kind of all-encompassing way of producing all kind of art genres. And of course, I think, I mean, we cannot neglect this part, but I think there is also somebody else who, in his paintings, refers not to Arabic or Islamic writing, but to more to Japanese calligraphy, who is Georges Mathieu. And Georges Mathieu, I just recently went back to his writing. It's very interesting because he has a very strong criticism of all the painting, the European painting coming out from the Renaissance. He says all what came out with Giotto, Cimabue, and then Da Vinci, and so on and so on, transformed, and this is very interesting also when we think of Islamic art, transformed art into handicraft. So he really takes the counter-argument of what is generally reproached to Islamic art, which is considered kind of handicraft and not a real art for a very long time in Europe. And he makes the contrary. He just says, no, what Renaissance art produced is really reducing art to a kind of a handicraft. And he speaks also of sclerosis, of ossification of art through the Renaissance art. And he says, we have to go back to the tradition of the Zen, Chan, and I don't know what. He quotes also Ibn Arabi and this kind of tradition to rethink of art. So how not to think of the Contemplative Manifesto by Shakir Hassan? You find an echo of it. Now, I'm not saying Shakir Hassan it's not at all my purpose. I want to be really clear about this. I want to even to say the contrary, and it's to end up with something like some tried to say earlier on. What I want to say is that generally speaking, of course, the reference that people like Shakir Hassan or other artists from the Arab world would quote, they like to quote Arabic Islamic references, Sufism, Ibn Arabi, I don't know, all the kind of tradition of the Arab thought, let's say. But what is interesting, so they for themselves, they want to be, as I said, rooted in this tradition. On the other hand, so it's very easy to read them only from this perspective, as Arab artists coming back to their own tradition, because they themselves say it. And so we tend to make them a kind of exotic, strange artists, you know, to single them out of major movements. And I think this is not exact, because those people, even, and again, even if they say, and I don't want to force on them a reading that they would refuse, what I want to say, and in the idea of, yes, reconsidering modernism, is that those people, yes, they were claiming that they were Arab, they were going back to their heritage, and we can see it also in Hamid Abdallah, but at the same time, they are part of bigger art movements. And I think this all, and this is why I spoke about Shakir Hassan al-Said, because he was in Paris at the time where those kind of ideas were in the air, they were in the debate. That was what artists were trying to do, coming from very different perspectives. So my purpose is, when we consider modernism in its different aspects, I think we cannot read it only from the geographical origin of those people. We have also to put them in a more large context. Of course, Shakir Hassan al-Said came back to Iraq in opposition to Hamid Abdallah, who stayed in Europe. But still, again, I think we have to consider, not in the way to include in some kind of modernist canon the others, so to not in order not to discriminate them, but we just have, when we consider what people do, we have to put them again in the context where this idea first appeared and where they developed ideas. Of course, again, I'm not saying they were taken from Georges Mathieu or others, but I think this kind of ideas fertilized a ground which allowed people like Shakir Hassan to go further in their own thinking. And I'm stopping here.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Well, I think it's quite interesting to get maybe a little bit of a mini panorama of sorts. And I think this question of origin and how do you deal with this is probably one of the central questions that many of the artists face, in fact, you know. And I think when you see the Art et Liberté group, who were, in their own definition, quite open and actually refused any sort of sense of nationality or borders or such, I think the core of the group was exactly to go over that and maybe in a local context, however, very directly speak to the population that was living there, really in a very direct form, and relocate that. And in fact, many of them were also then criticized for maybe being too international of sorts, you know, not really being Egyptian enough or so in the discussions that happened later on and so on. But what I wanted to ask you both really quickly, and then we will open up to the audience, is one question. We all agree, obviously, that's why we're working on these projects, that it is very important to understand this period of modernism, and in fact we know very little about it. You know, one of the things that we often encountered when we did this exhibition is that, oh my God, this was happening in Egypt, a complete kind of disconnect in a sense of even having a basic understanding of what a city like Cairo would look like in the 1930s or 40s, not even being 100% clear of what the governance structures were, sort of part of the British Empire, but how is that whole kind of modern city actually evolving? We have absolutely no idea of the modern city that Cairo was or that Baghdad was at this time. We think of it in terms of antiquities for sure, and then maybe a little bit the current moment of, you know, revolution and things. But really what happened, all this bit in the middle, is pretty much a big blank, you know, in terms of knowing it. And what I wanted to ask you both, maybe you start with Sam, is why, first of all, do you think that there is such a blank? Why do we not know this? And why is there such a lack of it, since a lot of people here are obviously connected also to the region? Why is that the case? And then the second part of the question, why is there all of a sudden, it seems it's almost a bit of a fashion, you know, to talk about new modernisms and go and discover all these artists and sort of integrate them and bring them to the museums. So these two things, why do we not know this? And why all of a sudden is there almost an, yeah, for better or for worse, you know.
Post-colonial guilt.
I think it's a poor question. Yeah. So Sam, what do you think? And then we'll have Sylvia also say a few words on that maybe.
I mean, it's a very broad question, and I think you can tackle it in so many different ways. The very simple answer is because the material that you need to be able to reconstruct the story has been scattered in so many different places. And I think the post-colonial reality of a lot of these places that the institutions were not prepared to properly receive, archive, catalogue, I mean, the lack of institutions on one hand, but also the scarcity of resources that were left or made available for these institutions to be able to collect and gather in a systematic, academic way, you know, all the material that needs to be collected, whether it's the artworks themselves and to have them on display or the archival materials, and then make them available to scholars. So I think a lot of the material, as we experienced also with the Surrealism in Egypt and with, you know, the Baghdad group of modern art and all these different movements, is that a lot of the material stayed in private hands, in the family, with the families, or with the people who were interested at the time because they were affiliated to these groups or to these artists. So a lot of the material is basically not accessible, and to make it accessible and to come back and publish it in a proper monograph or in a catalogue is a matter of years of work, is a matter of traveling across the globe to find these things and then to study them and make sense of them. I think this is one of the main challenges, and it takes time and it takes a lot of determination and a lot of resources. So you need all of these things, kind of. You need someone who's very determined, who is able to find the funding, and at the same time, who's able to study these things, has the, I don't know, the native language or whatever, you know, all these things. I think on the other hand, there has been a surge of nationalism, to your point, within a post-colonial reality, that has led to a certain writing of art history from within, that omitted a lot of things that did not fit the narrative at the time. So in a sense, with Art Liberté, they have been written off as a failed attempt to incorporate a Western art movement within a context that was not ready for it, that they were not genuinely interested or coming from the people, and that's why it wasn't interesting. While the contemporary art group, because they were from a certain class mostly, because they worked with the local vernacular, became the heroes of promoting for the first time an authentic Egyptian art, an art that is Egyptian, not an art that serves Egypt, but that is in itself Egyptian. I don't know how that could be possible. So not to refute or agree with this, I'm just saying that the writing of art history locally was also governed by a certain political reality, which led to the omission of certain things or the misrepresentation of others. And it takes a lot of scholarship and time to go back, find the primary resources, and kind of dialogue what has been written to what truly happened and be able to come with a rewriting or a revision. And I think this is work that takes decades. And I think now we're starting to see the results of work that has been happening probably for the last 20 years. There have been scholars, you know, working in this field, younger scholars coming into the picture and continuing and building on the work. And I think now it's starting to mature, and this is why you're starting to see more exhibitions and more publications, and I hope that this continues to happen. And I think I forgot what the next part of the question was.
Well, that's why is there more happening now?
Yeah. So I think this is why, and maybe the surge in interest in other in museums that are not from maybe the region where these artists come from. I was joking, but I think it has to do with post-colonial guilt. And I think sometimes these institutions miss a very important reality, which is, you know, they think if they show Diya Azawi here, they're doing a great service for the Arabs in the Arab world. Or if they show a great artist from, Nigeria, they're doing something great for Africa. They forget that actually the communities in this city are actually made of Iraqis and Africans, and it's their responsibility to connect with the cultures that exist in their city here before they even think of what's happening. So it's not anymore, oh, we're showing the white European, you know, citizen what happened in other parts of the world. It's actually showing people something that comes from their own culture, who are now part of this culture as well. So it's very interesting to think about these things.
And that complicates the notion of a Western audience quite nicely as well, which often gets cited to not knowing. Western audience in London, I think, would be a very interesting topic, you know, what that actually means. And
I may add a few things. You said, I think, essential. I think one of the main points is that it's very difficult to work on topics like this because, as you said, there are no archives. And I think this has probably to do with the fact that this is a quite recent phenomenon. And I think that in the countries themselves, a real interest is coming up in the last few years. And I think since you have people in the region itself that are interested in it, you have also more people working on it, studying this kind of topics. This is one side. If you want to take the Western part, of course, you have Magicien de la Terre and then all the evolution of showing artists from non-Western countries, which started in 1989, and then if you go now to big events of international art, you cannot not have any artists from, I don't know, the Arab world, China and Africa and so on, which was the fact before. And I can also tell what happened to me when I was starting my research, when I started my PhD thesis. I won't say in which year I started, but I went to see, so I did it, I registered in an Arabic studies department, but I wanted to have, I had studied art history also, and I wanted to have a professor of art history also co-directing my thesis, co-supervising. And so I went to see the professor that was then the professor of modern and contemporary art in Geneva, and I spoke about my project, and really at the time I think there was really nothing or very, very few things about it. He looked at me like this, well, I saw something like that in Tunisia once, and you know, this was really l'arrière-garde de l'avant-garde. So the rear guard of the avant-garde. And he closed the discussion with this. So now it has changed. I think this is, so I am quite optimistic, because even if it's still very difficult to do research in this field, I see that since the time I started, I mean, really, people working, studying, researching on the topic, exhibitions and everything has really exploded in some sense, even if it's still very difficult. And my dream would be that some university would really open a big research, but not one professor. One professor would be a start, yes, but that would be better than nothing. But really a university which would put the money also, but also really to do research and maybe to gather also all these private archives. So some libraries have some archives. For instance, the Bibliothèque Kandinsky in Paris has a lot of archives of artists who lived in Paris. So this might be a center, but still, in Paris, you don't have, even in Paris, in spite of a big Arab community of lots of artists that have lived there, you don't have institutionally anybody really working on modern art from the Arab world or the Middle East. You don't have it. So they all come to Geneva because they don't have any place to go, which is absurd in some way, you know. So anyway, so this is really something academia has still a long way to go. And I think it's necessary. But I'm really confident because I saw that there is a development, there is an interest. Today, no art historian, even if he or she is not interested at all in this, would speak like this anymore and say the rear guard of the avant garde anyway. And so, so it's something, and that's also the interesting thing about working on this kind of topic, because you really feel that it's something that has been being built up now. So and we are part of it. And I think this is an exciting thing. Even it's, again, and sometimes the other problem is when young people do PhDs on such topics and they spend a lot of time just to locate the archives and to get them and to be able to read them and consult them. Then if you have in the defense jury, you have some specialists of European art, they think they don't appreciate this hard work, which maybe took 2 years of the person just to get the material, which you wouldn't have if you work on European artists.
I mean, perhaps a testament to that is a little bit in the exhibition. We have well over 60 lenders in 13 countries, bringing together something like 100, 120 artworks and 200 documents. But if you see the number of lenders, this is a great indication, of, in fact, of the complexity, not only of organizing and bringing them together for an exhibition in terms of loans and transportation, but actually these 60 lenders, you know, had to be found, first of all. And then you have to convince them, you have to gain their trust until they're open. And these are the 60 that you then work with. And you get an indication of how many more. The number is probably 3 or 4 times higher of the people that you go through to finally find the material that you're actually looking for. So just to give you an indication of what it actually takes to do such a project. And it really, the material for Art et Liberté is scattered from all the way from California and Nagasaki to Tokyo to, you know, really around the, literally around the world. Because a lot of these people went there in the, you know, eve of the revolution and afterwards, and the material went there and ends up in the most eclectic places. I mean, one thing which I find really surprising in this is the manifesto, you know, which was printed and distributed in its original version and in quite a good number. We were able to locate 2 copies, and one of them is actually in Chicago and one of them is in Edinburgh. So, and we borrowed the one from Edinburgh. So just to give you a little bit of an idea of how much digging, and you can't just Google this because it's not prime material or go on online catalogs. You know,
no, Wikipedia is not very helpful.
And even in the library, because you really need to follow traces of where material could have ended up. You know, it's often, it's sometimes, it is in boxes or so, you know, that is not really catalogued, and it's a game of luck sometimes finding these things.
So was it in library, public libraries, or with private people?
No, the manifesto, yes, they were both in one is the National Gallery in Edinburgh.
Okay.
And it's the Roland Penrose archive.
It's the Roland Penrose archive, you know, so that's, but it wasn't clear, you know, after tracing the story of Roland Penrose back, you know, you then find it. And so maybe we can open up to the public for some questions. Yes, please.
So I'm wondering if you could thank you all so much for the talks.
Oh, thank you for coming.
Thank you. My pleasure. Can you speak more about the transmodernism? And we've talked about the central periphery, and the idea of central periphery is, you know, is a discussion that's been happening for a while. But the problem is, you know, you're talking about not doing the side-to-side comparison, which is important, so we don't have this idea of modern Arab art being deficient and lacking. But then the issue is that in the sheer name of modern art, you do have that inherent association with the Euro-American canon of modern art. So what, and not just having Arab art being an addendum or addition to that canon, what strategies do you maybe employ in your own work that dismantle that canon, as opposed to just creating another Arab art canon that they don't have to listen to, right? Because right now I'm teaching the first year art history classes, things like that, we don't have to look at this at all. And that's kind of the problem.
Well, I mean, transmodernism is just one way that we're looking into this, and it's a term that we definitely did not coin. There have been other kind of scholars or historians that talk about transmodernism, but in a very, very different way. Well, you know, the notion of something that is trans, it's something that is changing, something that is shifting. So it's not something fixed. And instead of talking about transnationalism, which makes the building block the nation, we're talking about transmodernism, which makes modernity one block. So there's something shifting constantly with modernity because of the mere fact that the people who contributed to it were actually people who were shifting as well all the time. whether it's in their thinking, whether them geographically moving from one place to another, and also temporally. So they were not also thinking about, you know, things that were happening at the time. They were thinking about the past. They were thinking about, you know, the ancient past, the recent past, and also thinking about the future, about the current moment. So transience, or something that's constantly shifting, is a very, very important thing. Another notion with trans is the notion of displacement, the notion of exile. And I think modernity is kind of bracketed and impacted by two major wars. And the fact that a lot of the artists and a lot of the thinkers and a lot of the writers who contributed to modernity were themselves, you know, victims or benefited from being displaced and being exiled, being able to experience something different because of that reality, can be something to factor into this whole notion of something shifting, something moving. So modernity is not a fixed thing. It's not a French thing. It's not an American thing. It's not an Egyptian thing. It's not a Japanese thing. It's an amalgamation of all these things and a dialogue of all these things that is constantly developing. And I think, so that's one way of looking at modernity in a different way. The other kind of reason why we would like to talk about transmodernism is because we're also trying to find a paradigm through which we can evaluate that moment that steers slightly away from Edward Said, slightly away from the whole post-colonial discourse, not to underestimate and undervalue the importance of, you know, the whole theory of Orientalism and the whole kind of body of critical thinking and writing that comes with it, starting with Said and going to many, many other writers. The whole discipline of post-colonial discourse, I think one of our reservations about this in this particular moment in time, maybe it served a very important purpose for a good two decades, is that it becomes a way of othering. So the exoneration that comes with post-colonial discourse and, you know, Saidian Orientalism is that the colonized obviously is the victim of the colonizer. And for centuries or for decades, for the art of the colonized to be of any value, it had to somehow fit and emulate the art of the colonizer. So, and when you look at, you know, when you look at a lot of exhibitions, when you look at a lot of writings that are underpinned with this way of thinking, you always feel that somehow there's an act of legitimization going in by going out to bring the other who has been a victim from the periphery, to place them in the center and give them the same importance and the same attention and the same value. And when you look back in time, Aghili Bighdeh is an example, Hamid Abdullah is an example, many of the artists from the Baghdad group of modern art are an example. They were not thinking of themselves as the other.
Oh, not at all.
They were not thinking of themselves as peripheral. They were not thinking of themselves as victims. They actually had a very confident stance on what was going on and were parts of a discussion, of a discourse. So equal partners in that discourse. So in a sense, to take the politics of today, you know, and kind of historicize what was happening back then is a counterproductive exercise. Hence, transmodernism could be a way of countering that. That's just,
you want to add something? Or?
Yeah, maybe. There is also another way, I think, to approach this kind of production. First of all, I don't see why we shouldn't introduce that in some general course about art history, maybe as examples, and not canonizing them, but when we speak about modernity, wow, why not putting in, and look what was happening in Cairo. When you speak about surrealism, it makes a lot of sense, what happened in Cairo, what happened in Latin America, and so on. And then there is, I think, another approach which art historians who are not specifically dealing with the region are more and more considering, which is the idea of circulations generally, and understanding modernity also as a kind of circulation. And I think, I don't know if you know the work of Béatrice Joyeux-Prunel. She is mostly working on Paris, and now she's working and deconstructing the idea of Paris as the center where the whole European modernity was happening. Because she shows how Yes, Paris was a center. She's speaking of the end. In her first book, she's speaking of the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century, this period where Paris was really central. But then she shows how much importance had shows in Brussels or in Berlin or in London or in other places which are considered peripheral also, because also within the Western art production, you have center and periphery, and not of speaking of Switzerland or Bulgaria. Anyway, still, even if Switzerland is an important market for art, but not for art production. And so I think if we take this kind of approach and we say, okay, there was Paris, but there was not only Paris, then we can have a multifocal approach of what modernity is. And then we can introduce Baghdad. We can also, introduce Saigon or I don't know which other city. And maybe introducing them, this is an example of, look, this happened in other places and look how this was understood in a place like Saigon. Let's not speak about Cairo or Baghdad. So I think this is the way, and I think I don't know if this will find place in art historical curricula, but I feel there is a trend into this direction, and this trend will allow also to include works like this, because then you have a very different way of considering modernity. You don't have this idea, like I got this definition of the modernity irradiating from the European center to the whole of the world, like Jean Baudrillard, for instance, formulated it.
I think there is also some pretty clear, obvious things. I think when you look at the time frame, especially of this exhibition that we did, I mean, when you look at Europe in the 1930s, and most certainly in the 1940s, where was that great art happening? You know, there was one fascist regime after the other, then there was the horrors of the war and the aftermath of the war. You know, why can't we just simply realize that that was not applicable to Cairo? You know, it was indirectly, of course, affected by the war, but it was a very different reality, you know. So the fact that we don't know this tells us also a lot that we maybe were quite busy with ourselves and trying to figure out how to continue from that in many European places. But really, there's obviously something happening that was happening that we simply don't know about. And the second thing is, what we know in art history and what we know in history at large is, in fact, the story of Paris as the great city. What we don't really know is that what made Paris a great city is the fact that so many people came from all over the world to Paris and brought their ideas with us. We know when we talk to one another in our daily lives in a very simple manner that both people leave inspired and change and exchange ideas, and somehow the story that art history tells us is actually the people that were then in Europe, they became these great innovators and these great things, and we know what happened to them. So if somebody looked at ancient Egyptian art, for example, and so many modernists were doing that, or in cases of so-called primitive art, which is also a terrible term, but so, you know, a lot of art that comes maybe from Africa and different places, they were the great innovators. But any artists that maybe were studying in the region, from Egypt, or Mahmoud Mukhtar, or other artists that were doing exactly the same thing, were often then ethnicized, you know, as some sort of Egyptian artist. You add that label to it, you know, when it's probably the same thing, and we certainly don't know what happened to them afterwards. So the story that is told is actually, you know, great ideas come, and then they're the geniuses, but what those people did before, or what they took with them, and how they left change, we don't know. We think of it simply as copying the great masters and the great innovators, and I think that's simply, on a very basic human level, completely unacceptable. Forget the historical gaps in the art.